It's ad break time. I'm proud to announce that the Beyond Solitaire podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they are up to some amazing things. Their next game, Hydrologic Cycle, is scheduled to come to Kickstarter on March 26th. CLGS also continues to offer classes in partnership with Gen Con. The next course, Classroom Game Design, Yes We Can, will be taught by one of my absolute favorite teacher gamers, Dr. Christiane Hintz. It begins on March 4th, and you should definitely sign up for it. I'll also include a final plug for myself. If you like the show and want to support it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. Thanks to listeners like you, I've been able to keep upgrading my equipment, subscribing to StreamYard, and more. But for now, let's get on with the show. Hey gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week on the pod, I have two very special guests. I am here with Dr. Paul Otto. He is professor of history at George Fox University. And I'm also here with Reverend Virtus LeVar Robinson. He's acting president of the National Issues Forums Institute and also minister at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. How are y'all doing tonight?
Wow. Yes.
Doing great.
It's winter.
Even here in Georgia, it's winter. But I'm super excited to have y'all on because I love talking to people about interesting reacting to the past games, and y'all have made one about Bacon's Rebellion. So for people who do not know what Bacon's Rebellion is, what is it?
Well, so, you know, in the quick and dirty version of Bacon's Rebellion, of the historical event, is that it was an uprising of disaffected groups in 17th century Virginia in the midst of a conflict between the colonists and the Native Americans. Nathaniel Bacon himself, unlike some sort of popular notions, was not impoverished or poor. He was actually a member of the English elite society. He was related to the governor himself. He was a member of the council. But he didn't have access to what he considered a good tobacco growing land. And he was out on the frontier and found a willing group of followers, hundreds of them really, who were similarly disaffected, some because they were impoverished, some though because they didn't have the political opportunities they wanted or that they thought were deserving of their otherwise socioeconomic status. So when there was an Indian uprising and Barclay didn't support their wishes for an offensive war against the native people, they decided to just take it upon themselves to go to war against them. And then they went to war against the governor. And that's Bacon's Rebellion.
Ooh.
Flashback to 2014. I'm a history professor in a community college. And I taught American history. And I was of the group that believed that institutional racism didn't start in the revolution or it didn't start in the Civil War, but it actually started much earlier. And when you have students and you're just going through the events and everything, I also like to believe that it's great to remind students of why we are in the state that we are right now, why we were fighting institutional racism, still fighting institutional racism. And there is this belief that Bacon's Rebellion was a pivotal episode that didn't cause the creation of institutional racism, but it was a factor that then led to the creation of institutional racism, and it really shows that quite well. And in an average history textbook, it's only given like a paragraph, maybe a paragraph or two, but what happens is basically a biracial coalition of people on the bottom unite and take over. And in order to make sure that that doesn't happen again, the elite divided that biracial coalition by the easiest way possible, by race, bringing white people above black people, therefore making sure that at least the lower class white people won't unite with the black people to take their position. So it's all about keeping power and control by making sure that at least white men were at least satisfied that they were above somebody. And Bacon's Rebellion really, really shows that. So 2014, I was introduced to Reacted to the Past, and I was playing these roles, and I got this emotional experience, and I was like, what is this? And immediately my will started churning. And that summer, in about a month, I created Bacon's Rebellion, and it was played in my class. And once it was played out in one of my classes, I was like, oh, there's something here. And so we started playing that, started really molding that. And I saw light bulbs go out after students played it to realize this is the beginnings of institutional slavery and institutional racism in America. And they really got the chance to see it and play it out.
Interesting. So for those of you who are out there and don't know Reacting to the Past, as I just realized I forgot to say this, it's basically a historical role-playing game that students do in classrooms in order to embody history, to play out history so they understand it better. Y'all both worked in educational settings. You're both reacting people. What made you do a reacting game together? So, Virtus, it sounds like this is your idea. How did Paul enter the stage?
Well, it was 2014, and then we were playing it. And then my capacity as a community college professor, I was teaching about 6 classes a semester, very, very popular courses. So I was having 240 students every semester, and not just American history. So I was doing stuff on the national level with civic engagement, and to get it to the next level so it can be publishable, that it can be it can be finessed and worked out all the bugs and then, you know, play tested abroad. There was a suggestion that I should have a co-author to help out with that part, and also the game mechanics part of it. And Paul's name came up as someone that was versed in the area of history and was a solid reactor. and so I approached Paul, and he agreed. And then we hit pandemic. So both of us had some time on our hands because of that. And without Paul, I don't think that this game would have gotten to the part where it is now. And that is, it's going to be published in March.
Beautiful. And Paul, what made you decide to take this on?
So, I got involved with Reacting probably actually about the same time as Virtus, although not through the Annual Institute. I'm out on the West Coast in Oregon, and I was at I'll try not to make this too long, but I went to a regional conference, I guess it was in fall of 2014, kind of begrudgingly, I'd seen the notice, and my dean said, hey, I'll pay if you go. And I said, I don't know, games, whatever. And then in October, she said, you know, they're still taking people and I'll pay. And I thought, oh, well, 2 weeks from now, I got that free. So a weekend free. So I'll go. I'll sit there and I'll learn. And I register, and then I'm sent a game book and a role sheet. And I'm thinking, well, what the heck is this? I didn't sign up to play a game. Reacting people saying, oh, yes, you did. So I went, I'd made the most of it. I actually like playing board games. I hadn't had much experience with RPGs. So this was a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but you know, my sort of recreational wheelhouse, but I immediately saw the potential, and I realized I'd already been thinking about how I might bring some kind of immersive experiences into the class. So the very next semester, I tried a couple reacting games in my American Revolution class. That was great. Then I was off on sabbatical. Came back, used it again in the upper division classes, and I thought, you know, I want to do this with surveys. So the very next year, so that would have been like 20, fall of 2017, I'm casting about for games, and I come across this level two, which is just a prototype of Bacon's Rebellion. I thought, Bacon's Rebellion. Oh man, that would be incredible. But like, can you really make a game of this? So I reach out to Virtus, because that's how it works before the games are sort of approved for distribution. And he very kindly said, yes, you can use the game. And then I had all kinds of questions because I was still kind of an inexperienced reactor. He's answering questions by email and then I'm making suggestions. So a couple of years before I came on as co-author, I'd actually been working with Virtus to make a few changes. And so as he was revising in those early stages, some of my suggestions were creeping in. And then the game had so much potential that, again, this is just all on the strength of Virtus's work, that the Reacting Central decided that they were going to run it at the Annual Institute as a level two game. I was there that year, but I wasn't playing Bacon's Rebellion. I was next door in the French Revolution game. And every time we come out in the hallway during breaks, people are coming out of their Bacon's Rebellion. Wow, this is an incredible game. And it was after that that Virtus is getting the pressure, like, yeah, you know, you need to take this up to the next step. And then he reached out to me. And I was like, yeah, I would love to. I mean, I'm already making some revisions. So that's how I got involved, both in reacting and then co-authoring the game. I just want to add that, I mean, one of the things that appeals to me about the game, in addition to this really crucial historical moment about, as you know, as we put it in the game, and I think this the language comes from Ira Berlin, you know, the transition of a society with slaves to a slave society, which is hugely important in the understanding of American history. But of course, the game itself doesn't just deal with that level of racism or that kind of racism. It also deals with English attitudes towards Native Americans and the complex circumstances there. You know, some of the other games, well, one of the other games that's set in the 17th century is the, it's the Anne Hutchinson game. Well, that's nice, but I feel like that's so historiographically, you know, tied back into New England. And ever since graduate school, I thought, like, the birth of America is happening in the Chesapeake. Like, I mean, everything that's going on in terms of the way our society is structured and the tensions between classes and races all grows out of the Chesapeake. So when I saw that Virtus was doing this game on Bacon's Rebellion, I thought that, yeah, this, if we're going to have one game on the 17th century, this is it, and it should be it. So, and I continue to work on this game with such an appreciation for Virtus launching into it. He says he knocked it out in a month, and that's true, but that's impressive, but I don't think people realize really how impressive it is. When I got to that prototype the first time and I saw all the nuance that was packed in there, the deep understanding that Virtus had of the racial issues that were going on and the interplay of the various groups, I was just dumbfounded. And it's been a real pleasure to just like enhance it and, you know, bring the mechanics of the game to such a place to enhance the nuances, right? And to capture those nuances better. But man, the kernel of the game is all Virtus's. I never could have done this by myself, even if I wanted to. So
fantastic. So we're talking about different layers of nuance in the game. And it seems like there are many different roles that students could play. There are people from different socioeconomic groups. There are people from different racial backgrounds. There are people with different priorities in this situation. What kinds of roles did you choose to have students represent in this game?
Most of the action takes place in the Virginia General Assembly. So you have the governor, and then you have the governor's council, which are men of station and wealth and power. And then you have the House of Burgesses. who are representatives of the different counties. So they're there. But in the gallery are people who are in and around Jamestown are people who have a stake in the matter. Some of them are landowners, and some of them are female landowners who can't be in the House of Burgesses and can't be on the council. And then you have Afro-Virginians who were there. And the reason why we know that they were there is because of doing research on court cases or even other assembly other matters of the General Assembly in which they were winning cases. And so we have their names. We have all of them. Every single character is a actual character that lived and was around there during the time or were actually at the assembly. So no one's fabricated, no one's really made up. And really to bring in Afro-Virginians who are largely left out of the narrative of Bacon's Rebellion until the end, when you have the last stand, the majority of them were Afro-Virginians. And then history forgets to, intentionally leaves out what happens to them. No one knows, it's a mystery. There's probably a mass grave somewhere. But those are the roles that students play. Now, in order to make the General Assembly work, the majority of the characters are on the Governor's Council and in the House of Burgesses. But we made sure that indentured servants were represented, Afro-Virginians were represented, enslaved Africans were represented as well. And also the relationships between them and the people who are the ones making the laws and everything of that nature, and their relationship to Bacon. So Nathaniel Bacon's a character. Governor Barkley is a character. I used to call him Reverend Berkeley until someone corrected me. It's actually pronounced Barkley. I'm like, oh, okay. That's not in the history books, but hey, those little details count, right? But Lady Barkley, who is the wife of Governor Barkley, history does not really show how much power she has. But when we really dug in deep, she was pulling a lot of strings in there because of the land that she owned. That's why she was the governor's wife, because she owned most of Jamestown. But she was asserting her power through her husband. And so that plays out in the game as well. So the students see the broad diversity of colonial Virginia and have that played out in a classroom, which a paragraph or two, you don't get that. You don't really feel that. You don't embody that. And you don't really understand how it was different from our government now, because it was very different.
So it sounds like this game is structured around kind of council meetings where people who represent just the public can also show up and kind of find ways to interject themselves. In order to let students really play the game, how closely did you stick to actual procedural rules of the time? And are there other ways that students can influence kind of the outcome of the game or like various votes or decisions that are taken? If maybe they can't talk, or if maybe, you know, I mean, what are the different kinds of ways they're able to participate?
You know, it's interesting. There are certainly reacting games where the legislative power, the voting power of some characters is really significant. And maybe characters who aren't part of that legislative body, you somehow wield influence through votes. So like, if you think about the Chicago 1968, which is about the Democratic National Convention, half the class are protesters that are out at Grant Park. But they actually are allowed some votes, not that they were in the convention, but they're given these votes based on how much they influence the media and things like that. We don't have that in that kind of thing in the game. And in part because the game has to drive people towards the rebellion. And so it's a little you know, we're kind of like puppet masters a little bit. And, you know, so Bacon can, you know, like the first legislative session is March, and the deck is pretty well stacked against him. It's possible that he could swing things the other way if he's a really effective player. But we've equipped Barkley with a veto, which that's when he would use the veto to make sure that he can go back the way he wants. And then, you know, and then we interject between March, the March Assembly and the June Assembly. The whole Bacon's now kind of gone on the rampage. It's not kind of a full-blown revolution yet, but it's you know, he's taken to arms. So in June, it's really his assembly, and we've swung and we kind of goose it to go back the other direction. But in doing that, you basically, the game's designed to frustrate all the non-voting players so that at the end of that second legislative session, when Bacon will basically decide to, you know, announce war on the governor, people are ready to align with whoever because they've been frustrated at that point. They haven't gotten what they've wanted. And then, depending on who wins the battle, which can we have a short version for most players, but then we have an extended one if people want to do that. Whoever wins comes in the last legislative assembly and makes whatever laws they want. Probably Barkley.
So we actually stuck to the because. The rules of the General Assembly are really public. So, I mean, of the time. So, but there are things like someone in the House Assembly person cannot show up intoxicated or they'll be fined, you know? And so, you know, that type of thing. So, but there are rules about when people should speak and when they can't. But we also want to make sure that if people had speeches to make, that if they weren't part of the assembly, that they were sponsored by someone, right. And because people were allowed to speak in front of the assembly, and people did, including people of color. But we basically stick to so that you get the feeling that you are in Colonial Virginia, in Jamestown, in front of Governor Barkley.
Interesting. So you also mentioned that there are Native Americans represented in the game. Did they also come and participate in these political processes?
Yes. In fact, it was very fascinating to find out that Coca Cask, who is the she's what they used to call her Queen Anne, but she was basically the chief of the Pamunkey, who Governor Barkley did have or did seek out to have an alliance with. And she was there. She was there with her son. And the son's father happened to be, you know, in the assembly. And so that plays out in the game, as well. So she is there and we have the, and it's all in the records. And so that's how Native Americans are brought into the game, but not a historical. She was actually there.
That's awesome. So speaking of historical versus like, I guess when you're playing a game, you always want to balance correctly between creating the right historical vibe and encouraging people to do things that are within the scope of the historical setting, but you also want them to have some agency and some choice or else it's not really a game. So it sounds like there are lots of things in the structure of this game where things are very weighted to kind of push towards historical outcomes or at least to create enough balance one way or the other or imbalance to create frustration. Where do your players have the most agency as they're playing? And do the results of the game sometimes surprise you?
Well, I'll start and then Paul definitely chime in. I'll go briefly. There is agency because there are... everyone has powers, if you will. If you're a woman, you may not be able to have a vote, but depending on where you end up, that group can have an advantage because of your status and things of that nature. So Just because you are a person of color doesn't mean you automatically go to Nathaniel Bacon. Nathaniel Bacon and his group have to do some convincing. You know, almost like in American Revolutionary War, where you have all these black people here, the loyalists as well as the patriots have to make inroads to the people of color. And in fact, the loyalists had more people of color because they gave them, like, if you serve with us, we'll give you freedom. Similar here. So Nathaniel Bacon, what are you going to do for us to be on your side? Barclay, what are you going to do for us? And so there's some negotiation that has to happen in between council meetings. So it could go very, very ahistorical. It really could. But we built in mechanics to be like, okay, Bacon cannot be alive by the end of the game. So no matter what, he has to die. Yeah. But, you know, but the thing about it is, like, I've played a game where there was an alliance between Barclay and Bacon. We're like, whoa, how did that happen? You know, someone didn't read their row sheets all the way through. So, you know, they were just like, I want peace. So I got to do whatever I want for peace. And I'm like, that's not your objective, but okay.
That's not what you want.
So let's play this out. And then in the debrief, you know, let's talk about how that happened, why that happened. And, you know, what were your choices there? Because that's interesting, you know, but, you know, so Paul, go ahead.
Well, yeah, just to add to that, I mean, one of the challenges with the game, and as I was beginning to make some refinements to the work Virtus had done, was deciding which characters to include and which to leave out. Because on some ways, the records are sketchy. But on the other hand, a lot of people are named. We know who the main supporters of Barclay are. We know the main supporters of Bacon. And it's easy to, like, just run out a bunch of roll sheets for all of them. But the game is really, because it's a civil war, you have to have a lot of indeterminates. So one of the things we did as we moved along, I guess I did, checking back with Virtus, because it's like killing your darlings. Like, I had to keep pulling faction people out, putting them much further down the roster, you know, the scaling roster, and throwing more indeterminates in. Because by the time you get past that second legislative session and it comes to war, it's just a war of numbers. And so, as Virtus said, Bacon and Barclay are making deals. So you have to have a big chunk, like about half of the players are indeterminate. And they've got their objectives that have nothing to do with the concerns that Bacon and Barclay have. They do have concerns with women's right to vote, like blacks' rights, well, either gaining freedom, or if they already have freedom, which some of them do, gaining the right to vote. Some indeterminates are whites who are debating about whether they want to expand indentured servitude or whether they want to actually downplay that and expand race-based slavery. So those are the kinds of bargaining chips, and they're going to be going to the two sides and saying, well, if you win, what laws are you going to pass? So everybody in the game, every character in the game has militia strength points. They have at least five, but a bunch of them are officers. We got majors and colonels, and they're worth 15, 20 points. And that's a lot of power to wield. And theoretically, to influence Bacon and Barclay. My challenge I don't think it's a problem with game design, but, you know, I've run the game a number of times now. My challenge is just to get students to do the kind of horse trading. If they're not told what deals to make, they just don't seem to understand. So you really have to kind of work behind the scenes and say, okay, well, what do you want? You know, tell them what you want. You got military strength points to sell.
That actually leads me to another question. So I think it's very interesting you mentioned that there was a game where clearly people didn't read the roll sheets all the way through because they were like, oh, I want peace. I'm going to just do what I have to do for peace. Yeah. Why do you think that that's happening? Do you think it's because the subject matter is so sensitive that students are afraid to get into the nitty gritty and touch it, especially from kind of the wrong side historically in terms of like how we understand these issues today? Or do you think it's just that students aren't necessarily paying attention? Do you think that negotiation is like a skill that they're coming in and they just don't know that skill yet? So maybe they have a hard time embodying their role. I'm just really curious about this.
For I'll chime in with that one. For that particular case, I was doing it as a workshop at a university of how to democratize a classroom. And so I had my civic engagement, civic education hat on for that workshop. And someone that had used Reacting before, because the majority of the people were being introduced to Reacting for the first time. This is at Boston University. But, you know, she was just brought in. She was put as Bacon because, you know, the assumption was that she could, you know, she can just, you know, go with the flow, you know. So she just glanced at the thing. So sometimes it's preparation. Sometimes it is character assignment, making sure that whoever you select to be those main drivers of the game will do their due diligence that are, you know, prepared, or that at least you have an open line of communication with them to be like, okay, and to nudge them as a game master, that type of thing. So for me, it was like the wrong person, you know, that I assigned as that crucial role. But also, I was brought to the back to the drawing board, came back to Palm, like, this happened. How do we twist it and finesse it so that that can't happen? So.
Yeah. And one of the things we did also to make this game more competitive or to bring agency in was to basically allow most players two tracks to victory. And the more I've done Reacting games, the more I like this, because I'm developing a couple of prototypes in South African history too. But you know, the easy way, or not the easy, the most straightforward way you win in Bacon's Rebellion is to be on the side that wins the war, right? And so, oh, I've signed up with Barclay. Barclay wins. I win the game. That had two problems. One was students figured that out. And so they were kind of like, oh, the wind's blowing this way. That's who I'm going to sign up with. And that wasn't very helpful. So and then the other problem was that they really did have a number of objectives that we'd given them that had nothing to do with winning or losing. So we basically said, okay, you can work for these objectives. And if you get half or more of them, you'll win regardless of which side you're on, or you'll win if you're on the winning side and you've accomplished one of those objectives. So that forced them to keep working on the objectives, but giving them an option either way. And then, yeah, and how they exercise that, whether they're going to exercise that militarily or they're going to try, you know, to apply things vote-wise, but not everybody can vote anyway, it still comes back to deal making. But having that two-track approach, I think, is really keeps all the players engaged, that they're not like, oh, this game's over for me, it doesn't matter anymore. Hopefully it matters right to the end. So
yeah, and to you know, the second part of that question about students' discomfort with this game, you know, it begins with, you know, what do we do with the Indian problem? That's what it begins with. And it ends with, like, how do we break the lower people who are not, you know, the colonial elite? How do we separate that group of people so that we can, so because they united together. We saw the power of the people, and they ended up burning Jamestown to the ground. So how do we prevent the power of the people from taking away our power? And then it turns racially. So I haven't witnessed students' discomfort about because the racial issues, they end up popping up all of us. I mean, that's just, and when that happens, I get so excited because I'm wanting racial issues, especially the integration of race and gender, that really comes up. And, you know, every once in a while, depending on what characters are assigned. And when it comes up, everyone pauses and like, can we go here? Is this okay? And this was like, yes, because this is where the game, this is, then also light bulbs go up. Oh, so it's not just about what do we do with the Native Americans? It's about us and how we are, you know, interacting with each other and who has power, who doesn't, and who maintains that power and how they maintain that power to be like, oh, we are messed up as a society.
So basically you almost sneak it up on them. Like you get them right. So used to talking about other things that by the time the discussion turns, they've been playing for a long time. They're all kind of settled into their roles and then boom.
Mm-hmm. It's really remarkable. You know, Bacon's Rebellion, as all the books will say, is not strictly about race-based slavery. But we know from the legislative record that it was a tipping point. And after Bacon's Rebellion, they, you know, the laws they started passing, the labor laws, all favored white workers and reduced significantly the freedoms and opportunities of Afro-Virginians. So, and you sort of set that up in the game book. And while there's a couple of the roles that will debate slavery versus indentured servitude, that's not where most people are. But they have the rebellion, and then Barclay's in charge. And again, and you have that last legislative session. And all of a sudden, they just start passing those laws. Like nobody tells them to do it. They're so immersed in it. They're like, oh, we don't want this to happen again. And there's not even that many enslaved characters in the game. But you know, that to me, when I saw that happen, that this game works. Like whatever else is happening, once they, without thinking, and it's scary as hell, but without thinking, decide to start passing the laws, just like they did in 17th century Virginia. So like, I know this game works.
So it seems then that like when things get difficult socially, ethically, students don't necessarily balk in the moment. So at what point do they fully realize, I guess, what they have done in the world of the game? And how do you work them through whatever responses they might be having?
I have witnessed it. As soon as, you know, Bacon is just like counting up the numbers and be like, okay, you know, what do I need to do? But the fact that especially in Bacon's role sheet, it is like Nathaniel Bacon was a slave owner. You know, he was a slave owner. And so it's just like, okay, I'm a slave owner. And, you know, but if I want these people on my side, what do I do about this? Like, and so as soon as Bacon is like, and also the other people that are with him, some of them are slave owners as well. And so they're just like, so they have to like figure out like, should like, what are we going to sacrifice in order for us to have power and, or to take over the government and have our interests being secured. But the conflict is, I mean, it happens. It's starting, I mean, that subtly, but by the end, it really hits home. And how we work through it is through the debriefing. And, you know, and that is, okay, so what really happened? Who was on what side? And then really announcing or really reading off the laws that that came up after Bacon's Rebellion, African men cannot have relations with English women, you know, laws like that to really divide the races and things, you know, it's to show who has power, white men, you know, that type of thing. And like, if someone is born, they inherit the status of their mother. So an enslaved person is a slave for life. So if you are born to an enslaved mother, you are then born enslaved and enslaved for life. That happens after Bacon's Rebellion in order to show who that enslaved Africans are going to be slaves, and they're going to be slaves for life, And so white men and white people, you don't have to worry about them taking over and being more powerful than you. So it sets up institutional racism by setting up institutional slavery. And you show that, and you'd walk them through that, and all of a sudden they're dumbfounded. Like, wow. And it happened here? Not 100 years later? So this is where it starts? At the beginnings of our democracy? The beginnings of our country? No. This is where it is? Yeah, it's powerful.
So do you have students who kind of want to push back against those conclusions for modern reasons? I teach in a public high school, and, you know, just even mentioning institutional racism as a thing that could exist has some people like having the vapors. and so how do you cope with that? Especially because I do feel too that attitude is also kind of moving into some university settings and with some university students. Have you gotten pushback? You know, how do you have people who don't want to necessarily accept those conclusions? How do you preserve, I guess, a student's right to come to their own conclusions while also like really illustrating for them and laying out what the history is saying?
So I want to understand the question better. You're saying these are students who just don't believe we've ever had that kind of racism, right? That it's institutionalized.
I think we have a distinct instinct in our current political environment to personalize racism and make it a personal trait, as opposed to an institutional pattern. And so I feel like a lot of our current political debates are around that, and that's also going to possibly impact where your students are willing to go with you when they are learning about history. Because as we know, history has consequences for later, even if we don't want to talk about it all the time.
Right. Yeah. You know, I personally haven't had that pushback in the classes where I've used the game. I was teaching on a Great Books Honor seminar a couple years ago, and I remember a student bringing up the treatment of the Irish, and I like, actually it was during COVID, and I was on camera, and the class was in person. My co-leader didn't do anything, and I really didn't think I could interject like with the technology. And then I wrote to the student later, and I said, you know, it was all very sort of polite. And I said, well, here's the brief history, and this is the treatment of the Irish and all that. And they thought I was rude, but I haven't gotten that pushback, really. Yeah. So I don't, yeah, it's, I couldn't even comment on how to respond to it.
Yeah, but I think it's because of the main issue of the game is not racism. It's not what do we do with the races? You know, how do we divide races? That's not the main issue of the game. The main issue of the game is what do we do with the Native American problem of the Native Americans who are attacking the frontier? How do we keep, you know, expanding colonial Virginia and keep the colonists safe? You know, that is the common ground. But what comes out of that, because of everyone's different interest in how we're forming this new society that is now having people who are of African descent who have as much land and sometimes more than the colonists, you know, I mean, British colonists, you know, that is starting to happen now because of the court cases. They're starting to win. And they were just like, wait a minute. But that's not the main issue of the game, but it creeps in organically. And so by the end, organically it happens. So it's not like you're going to, this is a game about racism and how we create racism. No, it just happens, you know? And so
yeah, and
that helps it.
Yeah. And it happens organically, and yet it happens within this highly structured society, you know, this colonial society that mimics the socioeconomic hierarchy of England in the New World with race consciousness and diverse peoples. So I think that when we, you know, the historical background of the game unpacks all that, right? We say, well, this is the nature of society in Virginia. You know, these are the people in power. It's men. They're white. They've got land. You know, you do bring in the color bar. I guess I feel like that anybody that any player or student engaging the game that would try to push back on the institutional side, they have to push back on not just institutional racism, but the whole institution of Virginian society, because it doesn't happen randomly. It's organically, right. It grows naturally out of the structure that they have, but the structure's already there. It's like, what do you, you can't like argue the one piece without dismantling the whole thing.
I mean, there are some games in which students are forced to take one side or the other and have to debate, or they have to say, for instance, you know, slavery, they have to pretend that they are for slavery and have to give speeches and things like that. That doesn't quite happen in this game. It happens a little bit, but there's always but there are certain roles that will come out if you have an enslaved person who is just like, you know, who, you know, speaks out against, you know, against slavery, and then they will come. But it's not like everyone is talking about slavery and pro-slavery and every, you know, but then people start to realize by their own roles what skin in the game that they have, and mm-hmm. so where they start to realize that everyone is affected by these arguments that are happening, that come up in the General Assembly, that we have the minutes for. So these actually happened. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, the pushback that I tend to get is that has to do with students playing these characters that do have to make some of these arguments. Because you asked originally about things that it's not happening during gameplay, but what do you do if it's at the beginning or at the end? So one of the things at the beginning is, yeah, we're casting roles, and a student gets a role sheet and says, oh, wait a minute, like, you know, this person, I don't believe what they believe. And it doesn't have to be as blatant as a 19th century pro-slavery advocate, but in the 17th century, yeah, it might be somebody like, oh yeah, you've got, you know, 10,000 acres of tobacco and you own slaves. That right there might stop a student. I'm more likely to have that. And my response is always that, one, it's a role, it's not you. But I always try to help students think about the learning experience as a collective learning experience and not an individual one. So we need everybody in this game to play these individual roles so that we can collectively understand what's happening in Virginia. We're not learning to be this particular role. We're just playing the role. And the role is about ideas so that we can experience this clash of ideas together. And out of that clash and those debates and the things that happen, then we have a better understanding of what's going on. I mean, that's what we're doing here. And I try to use analogies of, you know, actors and theaters and television, because goodness knows students are watching all kinds of things, film that have characters that they would despise and they would never want to be that person. But clearly they appreciate the actors who play those terrible roles so they could be entertained. Why not play some roles you're uncomfortable with so you can be educated?
So what do you think the role of discomfort is in the classroom? I personally think that any sort of push is good for me. Like, I like to engage with people I don't agree with, and I like to kind of ask myself questions I don't know the answer to, because I think that a little bit of that friction is good. But when you are working with students, especially students who may not have had that experience of education before, how much discomfort is good discomfort, and like, how do you care for them through that process?
There must be too much discomfort. I guess I try to avoid getting the students to that point. I do surveys on all the games that I run in my classes, and I use a lot of reacting games in my classrooms. So I probably have taught at least 10 different games by now. I will never put a student in a role that they just really absolutely don't. So, I mean, I guess that level of discomfort, if I'm having to twist their arm, yes, I wouldn't have them play at that level of discomfort. But yeah, I do. I certainly have had the occasions where I've had to have a lot of check-ins with a student, talk them through, help them think about, you know, what they're doing. And maybe I'm just thinking about how they might be inarticulate and I'm being inarticulate. but you know, I've had students that like the role is on the surface so difficult. They're like, I don't know how to argue this. So I actually, you know, will have to help them make those arguments. Like, well, your character thinks this. Like, I mean, let's use slavery as an example. You're making an argument that it's economically viable. What's the evidence in the cortex? Sometimes I just have to really break it down. You know, in that cortex, what did you see? Oh, I saw this. I said, well, that's something you could say in character. You can make that point. One of the things that I started doing a couple years ago was to allow students in person, so in character, but sort of not in character, just say, like, you just made a speech just before, just after, you could say, these are the opinions of my character and not me. Or one of my students came up with this phrase, host body, which I think found its way into our instructor's manual. So I'll say that, or I'll tell them that now. So they'll say the host body of this character does not hold these views. And it's not terribly distracting. And it allows them, they just need a little something, right, to distance themselves from what they're doing. And it seems like once they're able to distance themselves publicly or however they need to do it, then they're able to play those roles more.
Yeah, and I would also add, because it's been a while since I've been out of the classroom for about the past 7 years, including during the pandemic. But I'm curious as to reacting and the pandemic, because a lot of people's patience with dealing with discomfort because of the pandemic have shortened. So especially in their jobs, like, okay, I'm like, life is too short. If I don't like much, I'm not going to do it. Same thing with the classroom. I think that's happened in the classroom. If they get into a class and they're just like, okay, this is a lot, I'm taking another class. I'm interested to see, because I had that happen in my classroom, where I would even tell you from my first experience doing reacting as a professor, and I had to play a role of a slave owner, and it was an American Revolutionary game. And I had to play a role of a white slave owner, and there were people that were enslaved that had to, you know, argue for their freedom, and I had to come after them and, you know, counter-argue them being, and from someone who is a descendant of enslaved people, what my arguments I had to come with was like, I went to the main people at the time in tears in my eyes, like, I just betrayed my whole race. Like, what is this? What are y'all doing? This is awful. And then I started to get it, because even though that was awful, I felt like, you know, I want to bury my head in the sand right now. I can't show my face. Like, you know, it was still and the way I was guided through that was, you feel what you're feeling right now? You see what you're feeling right now? And also, you just embodied a different character that you do not agree with, but you still argued that. And so you got a chance to walk a mile in their shoes. And it was discomfort, but I mean, it was uncomfortable. But without that, I mean, history can be so two-dimensional. This makes it three-dimensional. You know, it really does. And so walking a student through that to say that this is the purpose for this, but and also understanding that is not for everybody. It is not for everybody. And to be mindful of that too.
Interesting. I'm thinking back to the starting premise that kind of binds everybody together at the beginning of this game, which is the Native American problem. That also, I think, is sort of an interesting us versus them setup that I'm sure was historically there. But how do students respond to it? And then also, how do you make sure that Native American representation in the game is respectful when that is like the opening issue?
That was tricky. I mean, that is tricky because, I mean, they use words like savages. I mean, that's in their documents, right? So when people give speeches about Native Americans, are they going to be like, no savages, we got to get rid of them? The fact that in every game, you know, no matter what, COCACAS needs to be there. So in other words, a Native American, not just any random Native American, but the leader who happened to be female, and that is historically accurate, is present. So that helps that part of it, because you have some people saying all Native Americans, and some people are like, but we have someone here who is representing our allies, so it's not all Native Americans. That is what the governor is arguing by bringing in COCACAS. So that comes in, and so, but that is historically accurate, because a year before then, we had a mass, uprising. It was a slaughter, genocide happening in New England. And so Pete Phillips' war. And so that is on like everyone's mind. Like, we just saw something like just like hundreds of colonists were slaughtered and Native Americans were too in New England. Is that going to happen here? So we just don't drop people into Virginia. We go back and saying, this is what happened, and this is what's informing these conversations and these arguments, and it's coming to the assembly. That's how far it's gotten.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's an interesting situation because historiographically, because the kind of the Whiggish history has tended to make Bacon out to be, a proto-revolutionary, and Berkeley represented loyalist forces, but you know, neither of them are very nice people. They both have their problems. But when it comes to the Native American circumstance, Berkeley understands the complexities. He's been there for 40 years or something. And like Bertus says, he's working in alliance with COCACAS. He's very attuned to what's happened in New England, or what's even happening at virtually the same time. He doesn't want a massive war with Native tribes, you know, running all the frontier towns to the ground. So he's working very hard to try to maintain as peaceful relations as he can, not to provoke further violence, even though, you know, I think from the English perspective, on the surface, there's every reason for them to, you know, to take the war back to the Indians. I mean, they're wrong, but I mean, I can see how many of the colonists feel that way. And so you get like, when the game starts, if the game masters have set the game up right and the students have read the game book and understand it, they should appreciate that it's a fairly complex circumstance. And then, and COCACAS's presence is great, but even more importantly, she has a third option. She can go with one side or the other, but we've also set it up so that she can pursue neutrality. She can like, oh, I'm just taking my warriors and we're going to go into the dismal swamp and hope to avoid everything. Which was actually a viable native practice. She's in every single game, and we need her there. We need her there for her presence, for her leadership. We need her there so that students understand that not just that Native Americans are ever present, but the relationship between the English and Native people was complicated, and it wasn't just a white-black on-off kind of circumstance.
And we do have an advisory about playing race and racial issues, and because a lot of the Native American issues was not just about who was there first and things like that. It was racial. Right. Absolutely. So it's not just black and white race. I mean, it was racial. So that's for the game master, and it's also in the game book itself.
Yeah, and people also don't appreciate that the slavery that was being practiced even before Bacon's Rebellion included the enslavement of Native people. And that, which only gets worse after Bacon's Rebellion.
Right. But, I mean, Governor Barclay had enslaved Native Americans on his plantation during the time. I don't think that plays that much of a role in the game, but you know, that's historical truth. Yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like y'all have really like brought something to students that is compelling and challenging and something that maybe has to be dealt with some sensitivity. So kind of as like a wind down question, what advice would you give to faculty who want to introduce reacting to the past to their classrooms and have not done it before? Because it sounds like, you know, y'all have a lot of experience kind of bringing off a game like this, but everybody has to start somewhere. So if you are new, how do you get into something like this?
Don't start with this game. I don't know that that's true. I mean, when Virtus first developed it, his idea was for this to be a game that would introduce students to reacting. It was a little shorter. I lengthened it. But it is a challenging game. So I'm only half joking about not starting with it. And I feel like Virtus may disagree with me, but the environment now, 9 years on from when he first drafted it, is different. I think it's more challenging to deal with racial issues in the class and to do so in this creative gameplay way. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but my initial sense is hesitation.
Mm. I would say get a game book, preferably one that is published, because those are the ones that have been vetted, those have been play tested, you know, a lot and everything, and edited, you know, to and things of that nature, and just read through it. It will seem so overwhelming. Like, how can, I mean, I already have a curriculum, I already have a syllabus. How am I going to do like a game where I have to take weeks out of my curriculum to do that? After doing that, you don't have to do it in this order, but you know, there's a community on Facebook that you can ask questions, you know, and game authors are on there, like, and newbies are on there, as well as people who have been doing this for many, many years since the beginning, is on there to be, and it's very, very active, very, very active. The other thing is to attend a conference. So, I mean, the conference, they have workshops and everything, you know, about if you're new to it and, you know, racial issues, inclusion issues and things like that. Workshops, but you also get to play a game as though you are a student. So you get to have that experience of this is what it's like to be a student playing this game. And then to be able to ask questions of people who are there. Most of them are people who use reacting regularly in their classrooms. And to be able to break bread with them and, you know, and to say, okay, so how are you really doing this? And ask questions and things of that nature. So that's my advice. Not necessarily in that order, but, you know, but to do, if you do all of that, it gives you a pretty good sense of what reacting is and how it plays out in the classroom.
Yeah. And if somebody's watching this interview, this podcast, and they're saying, oh, I've never heard of reacting, I want to try it. I do know that the published games have gone through rigorous review. They've been play tested a bunch of times with students at multiple schools, with faculty several times. The game book itself is accompanied by the detailed role sheets and by an instructor's manual, which is also carefully written. We'd like to think they're self-contained, like everything you need is there. There's always questions. So as Virtus says, get on the reacting faculty forum on Facebook, because people are so responsive there to questions. And every game author I know in the reacting community will directly answer a question if they're available and you contact them either on that Facebook page or or by email. It's a really enormously supportive community. I would also say this, because I know there are instructors, there are faculty who feel like everything has to work. Like they want to be in control. They want to know the outcomes. You got to let that go. You have to just run a game, recognizing that things are not going to go the way you expect, but I guarantee that the students will learn regardless. Like I've never had a reacting experience where the students didn't learn. Even games where like the students seemed really unengaged and I was having to pull strings and prod and do all this. And I think, oh, I'm never going to be reacting again, you know? And then at the end, there's like, this was so great. I learned so much. I'm thinking, well, where was that enthusiasm during the game? But it works. It works even when it doesn't look like it's working. So
fantastic. So kind of on a lighter note, as we reach the end of the interview, what have y'all been playing for fun recently? A lot of people who make games for the classroom also like to play themselves. So if you're playing games, what have you been playing that you like? And if you're not, what other media would you recommend that brought you joy?
I want to hear Bertus's answer first.
Well, I'm a video gamer. So I escape to fantasy worlds and I fight dragons or help dragons or whatever. So I've been playing this something called Divinity, and it's like the Original Sin 2, and it's on iPad, and in which you go on this journey to become divine, and you have this, and so you can help people or you can just kill everybody. You can help a dragon and he'll help you out, or you can fight him. There's all these questions. At the end, you can be the only divine, or you can share it with everyone, so everyone has a little bit of the divine in them. And so I played it both ways, and you know, if I want to escape, that's what I do. And nice. So turn based.
That's very
role playing game.
Cool.
So I like playing a variety of board games, and I'm most interested in the ones that are historically based. But the thing that I'm enjoying the most right now is I'm with a group of guys that, and they're all men, so I guess we're guys anyway, that do science fiction based RPGs. And we're running two at a time. So I'm in one group, or the one game is Dune, which just came out a year or so ago. And the other one is Blade Runner, which also just came out.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And then just one more question, since people got stuff to do. But just one more question. If people want to follow your work and see what you're up to, where can you be found online?
That's a good question. I have a under-constructed... Well, I don't know the webpage address anymore. I'll have to tell you, and then you can print it. But
yeah,
you can find
me a link for the show notes.
Yeah.
My website is Reverend, and then -Vertus.com. That's my website, my ministerial website. But I also have my community engagement, civic learning stuff on there, and my music ministry. I'm a performer as well. So I lead a gospel choir in Vermont. Talk about racial issues and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Gospel choir in Vermont, so.
Awesome. I, of course, can be found anywhere online as Beyond Solitaire, for those of you who are out there. And Paul, Vertus, I want to thank you both so much for coming on. It's been wonderful to talk to you about your game. I kind of wish I could go back to class just so I could play some of these.
Thanks for having us.
Come to the Annual Institute in Barnard.
You know, I do need to make it one of these years for real. But seriously, thank you both of you so much for coming on. Everybody who's out there listening, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.